The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Osteomyelitis, septic arthritis, Lyme arthritis, rheumatic fever, and AIDS arthritis is presented by Dr. Howard Feinberg.
Okay, so our next group of diseases, infections in bone and in and around joints, we're going to talk about osteomyelitis and septic arthritis. Again, I'm sure these are problems that every one of you has seen. I have yet to meet an internist who hasn't had a diabetic patient who developed a diabetic foot ulcer and developed osteomyelitis, had a toe or more proximal amputation as a result of it. Osteomyelitis is inflammation of the bone caused by a pathogenic organism, so an infection in the bone. It can be caused by hematogenous spread, so any type of bacteremia can lead to this, or by continuous spread, like the diabetic foot ulcer that I mentioned, or an infection in a joint or an abscess that is close enough for the bone to fistulize into it. The number one organism is Staph aureus, far and away. So any questions of an infected bone, you want to treat your patient for Staph aureus based on the sensitivities at your local hospital. We also see coag-negative Staph and strep. Those three by themselves make up more than 90% of the cases. You can see polymicrobial either in patients who are immunocompromised or in diabetic foot ulcers where multiple bacteria can get in through the foot ulcer. And here's another one that shows up on boards that probably shouldn't. Sickle cell disease, 50% of the time salmonella. And I will tell you, no one believes that. It does not occur 50% of the time. It took me 15 years to find a sickle cell patient who actually had salmonella in a joint or in a bone. However, that's the published number, and that will show up periodically on boards. So please remember, sickle cell disease, consider salmonella as an infected organism. We also see gram-negative. Often that's a pre-morbid event in immunocompromised patients. Tuberculosis in patients who have disseminated TB. And in the HIV population, we'll sometimes see fungal infections, other mycobacterial infections, nocardia infections affecting the bone. In cancer patients also, we see a wider range of infecting organisms, so you have to remember that those patients are immunocompromised. In patients who are immunocompromised for other reasons as well, we see things like histoplasmosis, coccidioidomycosis, depending upon what part of the country you're in. Clinically, this manifests differently if it's acute or chronic. Acute infections, often they will have a fever, sometimes tenderness overlying the area, muscle spasms overlying the area that can point to the location where we're having problems and vague pain. And I put down children there just in case you wind up getting stuck seeing kids. I know most of us take care of over 17. They'll tend to have much more acute symptoms with it. Chronic, on the other hand, they may have night sweats, they may have a low-grade fever, they may have none of those. The symptoms may be a lot less more subtle, you may have weight loss. If it's been there for a while, sometimes they'll fistulize and you'll get a draining sinus, so you'll have a source of infection, but that doesn't have to occur. You sometimes will have tenderness or spasm over the area, but they may have little or no symptoms. On laboratory also, acute and chronic look different. Acute, we'll see an elevated sed rate, an increase in the white blood count. You can get positive blood cultures in up to 50% of them, so you may get lucky and be able to get a positive culture and see your Staph aureus. Usually you can get a positive result on a bone biopsy or bone culture. You also see elevation in other phase reactants, and occasionally you can get the organism in a urine culture. Chronic, you will usually see an elevated sed rate, other phase reactants may be up, but the white blood cell count can be normal. It may still be elevated, may be elevated at any level, but you can't rely on that. cultures are usually negative in chronic osteomyelitis. Bone cultures and biopsies have a very low yield. So very difficult to get the organism that way. You have to have a high index of suspicion. Plain x-rays early are a really bad test. They won't show anything for at least 10 days, often for 6 to 12 weeks. They will develop a lytic lesion or a bone lesion on plain x-ray eventually, but I would not recommend that as a diagnostic test. You can use bone scans. The affected area will show inflammation. The gold standard now has become an MRI where you can actually see the inflammatory process in the bone. So if you're asked one diagnostic test, what the best diagnostic test is, would be MRI. You can still use bone scans. For spinal disease, we will often see this affecting a disc and the bone on either side, and it can cause collapse of that area and fusion, and that's really what I'm showing here. This is an infected area, and the end result is fusion of the bone. So infected area where it's eroded into the bone here, and then healing with a complete loss of disc and fusion. Treatment, so this is from Harrison's, acute IV antibiotics for at least 4 to 6 weeks. Not unusual for the antibiotics to be continued longer than that, for patients to get a 3-month course of antibiotics. This is really the minimum, IV, at least 4 to 6 weeks. And then I don't know if this will be on the boards yet because it's 2017 and it can take a little while, but 2 years may be enough for it to show up. This trial has shown that oral antibiotics are just as effective as IV after debridement. So if there's been bone debridement, you do not need to use IV. You can use oral antibiotics to treat them. For chronic treatment, the main treatment is surgery. So surgical drainage and debridement, and then vascular assessment. If they have a prosthesis in the area, that has to be removed, and amputation if you're unable to debride away the area and heal it that way. Okay, TB. TB of the bone does occur. I'm in Northern California. We have a big immigrant population in that region. We see a lot of TB coming into our area, and we see TB in the bone. It usually affects weight-bearing joints, but there is an entity called Pott's disease, which is, TB of the spine, which will also destroy the disc, can cause vertebral collapse, spinal cord compression, and often will result in fusion. Most common joints would be the hip or the knee. Again, Pott's disease, TB of the spine. All right, we're gonna change gears a little bit and go from bone and joint infections now, or bone infections to joint infections. Joint infections also very common. There's something in my previous life in full-time clinical practice I saw all the time. Now I'm more of a bureaucrat. I only practice one day a week, so I don't see them quite as often. By far the most common is gonococcal arthritis. Back when I was in training, that represented 90% of all cases of infected joint. Now it's down to only about 50%, but it's still the number one cause of an infected joint. If you cannot get the diagnosis from the joint or don't feel comfortable tapping the joint, you can do pelvic exams or urethral swabs and get the diagnosis that way sometimes. This is very difficult to culture. You're not gonna get it in a standard culture. You do need to do an anaerobic culture usually for this. What we normally recommend is you do polymerase chain reaction testing for the joint fluid and for any swabs to try and get the organism. But if you don't find an organism, number one would be assume GC, treat for GC. For non-gonococcal, the most common is Staph aureus. That represents about 35% of all cases. So between the two of them now, we're up to 85%. And then beta hemolytic strep is another 10% of them. So now we're up to 95% of the cases by looking at GC, Staph, and strep. They can be gram-negative infections. They can be polymicrobial. They can be fungal. Those are typically in the immunocompromised host. Polyarticular septic arthritis is less common. We'll see it move from joint to joint in gonococcal. So if you get a case where you are given something that looks like a septic joint, and the key to that is white blood cell count in the synovial fluid will be over 50,000. And initially, one knee was swollen, and then a different knee, or a wrist, or an elbow was swollen. Think gonococcal, because it can move from place to place. Non-gonococcal polyarticular disease has a much worse prognosis. It's often a premorbid event in people who are extremely immunocompromised. Typically, they're ICU patients of mine who are on immunosuppressive therapy, oncology patients, patients who have AIDS, who have had multiple infections in the past. Those patients may have multiple organisms that you'll have to treat. Often, they don't do very well. Okay, so gonococcal, again, it can be a migratory arthritis. It can also look like a tendon or bursa infection. They may or may not have fevers. Usually it's fairly low grade. And there's also a skin manifestation, and it's a small bullous lesion, which you can see here. You can stick a needle in that, get a little bit of fluid out of it, and can also get the diagnosis from that. And synovial fluid is very difficult to culture anything out of. For gonococcal, even more difficult. It's rarely positive. You have to be there with an anaerobic culture, do it yourself, get it to the lab yourself, and get it into medium right away, or you're not going to get an answer. You can get it from urethral or vaginal cultures. What we normally recommend to identify it is PCR. Treatment, again, based on local sensitivities, but the published treatment of choice is ceftriaxone. It used to be that the GC that went to joints was penicillin sensitive. That hasn't been true for a number of years now. So it's ceftriaxone. It's the only type of infected joint that can be treated easily as an outpatient with dose of IM. Ceftriaxone, they respond rapidly to treatment within 24 to 48 hours. Yeah. Okay, for distribution, number one is the knee. About 50% of cases will be knee. Next below that is hip, and that is skewed a little bit because the pediatric population is included in there, and they tend to get hip infections more than adults. Then shoulder, wrist, ankle, and then more peripheral joints. And this is what it looks like. Red, hot, swollen joint, very painful to the touch. It looks just like gout and pseudo-gout. On x-ray, you can see inflammatory changes, and then we'll start seeing erosive changes. Outcome, these numbers haven't changed in over 30 years. Between 5 and 15% mortality rate, and that's because the population that typically will get an infected joint is compromised. Younger, healthy people who have a knee infection tend to do much better. Polymicrobial infections, much worse for outcome. About 70% will have a full recovery, and again, the group that recovers the best from this is a relatively young, healthy person who got exposed to a bad bug and got in a knee joint. And GC, again, a better prognosis than other infections. Worse is polyarticular. They have an overall mortality rate of close to 25%. In RA, it's 50%. Other immunocompromised states, it actually goes up even higher. In the HIV/AIDS population and in the oncology population, even higher. All right. Am I over time here? I just noticed my timer went up. All right, I have one more disease that I will go through very quickly for you then, rheumatic fever. Rheumatic fever, we have the revised Jones criteria. Jones criteria have been around for a long time. Rheumatic fever is still around. These patients, you have to have some evidence of a strep infection, and then here's the criteria. The main difference between the older criteria and the new revised criteria is that there's risk categories. So if they have a moderate to high risk, they're in an area where this is known to occur. The old criteria are pretty much still the same. The changes are down in the minor, where you see the SID rate only has to be 30 if they're in a high-risk area. If they're in a low-risk area, the SID rate needs to be 60. And oligoarthritis also in that category. Treatment, if they have no cardiac involvement, you treat for 5 years. If they have cardiac involvement and they're younger, you treat them for at least 10 years or until age 25. If they have any residual scarring or cardiac problems, they're treated for a minimum of 10 years, and usually those patients are treated for life. And then if they have significant valve damage, valve replacement. Not sure if my timing here is right or not, but I do want to cover Lyme disease quickly. So Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi is the spirochete that causes it. It's is the causative organism for 95% of all U.S. vector-borne diseases in the United States. So it is the most common vector-borne disease. There are three stages: early, where you see a rash, erythema migrans; early disseminated, where you can see a rash and migratory arthralgias; and then late, where, again, they can have skin changes, arthritis changes, and neurologic changes. This is the tick bite. It's a very small area. This is the rash, erythema migrans. It has central clearing and looks like a target lesion. The diagnosis is clinical. It's not based on lab. You can culture the skin. You can also do ELISA Western blot studies. You can do PCR for the joint fluid. You can look at spinal fluid, but the diagnosis for this is clinical. Patients have positive tests and do not have the disease. Patients have the disease, have negative tests. So you cannot trust the tests by themselves. Treatment: if somebody has a tick bite in an endemic area, you give them a single dose, 200 milligrams of doxycycline. Early disease, 21 days of doxycycline. Neurologic disease, 28 days of ceftriaxone. Arthritis, 30 to 60 days of ceftriaxone. Carditis, 21 days of ceftriaxone. And I will stop there. Thank you. Now I have my synovial fluid that I'm going to run through very quickly. Okay. And I'm sorry if I ran a little bit over. I will make up as much time as I possibly can right now. So I'm on time? Okay. For some reason, the timer is telling me I'm 15 minutes over here. I didn't realize that I was running over before. All right. So synovial fluid analysis. This also shows up on boards. I don't like this system of evaluating synovial fluid, but it is the system in the textbooks, and it is the system that will show up on boards. So we're going to cover the nomenclature. We're going to cover the appearance of some common and actually some less common, and go over some of the basic and specialized tests that need to be done in it on synovial fluid. The first step is stick a needle in a joint, get some fluid out. If you're doing this, I recommend you use as large a gauge as you can. So for large joints, knees, shoulders, hips, you want 18-gauge needles. For smaller joints, you may have to go down to a 20-gauge needle because 18-gauge may be too big to fit between the joint space for a toe. But you want to use the largest gauge that you can. Synovial fluid tends to be thick, goopy stuff. It's hard to get out. And then you want to look at it. So normal, it's going to be clear and colorless. Osteoarthritis or degenerative problems, slightly yellow color, which is going to be the majority of fluid that you're going to see. Inflammatory fluid may lose its translucence, may turn into a darker color. It could become hemorrhagic or bloody looking, could look white like the gout fluid that I showed you. So first step is look at it. Look at the volume. Normal knee has 1 or 2 milliliters of fluid in it. If you're taking out 130, there's definitely a problem in the joint. Do a cell count. Cell count over 50,000, it's infected, unless proven otherwise. And I don't know how you'd prove it otherwise. Every one of those really recommend you treat for infection. Below that number, above 100, 200 cells is probably inflammatory. The textbook number is 300 cells is considered inflammatory. Typically for rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, you're going to see white blood cell counts in the hundreds to low thousands. In gout, you may see white blood cell counts in the hundreds to 10,000s range. Look at how thick it is. The more inflamed it is, usually the more watery the fluid that will come out. do polarized light microscopy and look for crystals, and then get a gram stain and culture. So any fluid that comes out, I will record what it looks like to me and the volume that I've taken out and a relative viscosity of the fluid, and then we'll look at under polarized light or send it to the lab to look at under polarized light and order gram stain culture sensitivity on the fluid. Specialized tests, if you think you have one of those apatite or other calcium-containing crystals, would be alizarin red and von Kossel black stain. Cytology, if you're worried about malignancy. X-ray diffraction to do some crystal identification for ones that aren't visible under light microscopy. Mucin clot is an old test for rheumatoid arthritis. It used to be part of the diagnostic criteria. It no longer is, but it's still out there and still available. Measuring viscosity in the lab can be done as well. Generally, I don't have a huge need for that. Glucose, all right, so glucose levels are very low in patients who have malignancy, patients who have infection and rheumatoid arthritis. They tend to be high in other diseases. And then we can use nucleic acid amplification tests, PCR, looking for specific problems. So we divide the synovial fluid into four groups, group 1, 2, 3, and 4. One is non-inflammatory, that's going to be osteoarthritis. Group 2, inflammatory diseases. Group 3, infected joint. And group 4, hemorrhagic. Here are some common diseases that fall into each of those. Group 1, again, osteoarthritis, thyroid-related arthritis, osteonecrosis. Group 2, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, crystal disease, reactive arthritis, or the old Reiter's disease, enteropathic arthritis, Behçet's disease, all the inflammatory diseases that rheumatologists love to take care of. Group 3 is infection. And group 4, hemorrhagic, is going to be bloody-looking fluid, either from trauma or from a bleeding disorder or malignancy, villonodular synovitis. This is what the lab testing on the fluid will look like. So normal, very low volume. Again, a knee would have 1 or 2 milliliters. Smaller joints, much less fluid. The viscosity is going to be high. Color is going to be completely clear. You'll be able to see through it. It'll make a good mucin clot. The white count will be low. This usually will be 0, 1, 2. So white count normally very low. That's the maximum number. And culture is normally negative. So group 1, osteoarthritic fluid. Again, relatively low amounts of volume for most patients with osteoarthritis. That's not an absolute number. I have taken large amounts out of some patients with osteoarthritis, but relatively low volumes, high viscosity still. It'll be yellow, but clear. You'll still be able to see through it. It'll still form a good mucin clot. The white count will still be low. Culture is still negative. Inflammatory diseases. The volume will be higher. The body keeps producing fluid as a result of the inflammatory process to try and cushion the joint. The viscosity starts going down the more inflammation that you see in the joint. It will be yellow and start getting cloudy because of the number of white blood cells in the fluid. Mucin clot will become friable. The white count will go up, and again, typically, you're going to see somewhere between the 200 and 50,000 number, but it can go much higher and masquerade as an infected joint. And then group 3, again, usually a high volume. The viscosity can be variable. The color can be variable, often not be able to see through it because it's inflammatory there. It will form a poor mucin clot. White count now over 50,000. Culture is variable. Again, don't rely on cultures for infected joints. So this is normal joint fluid. It's completely clear. You'll rarely see that because generally you're not tapping joints that have minimal amounts of joint fluid and are completely normal. But if you did, it would look clear. This is osteoarthritic fluid, gout fluid, hemorrhagic fluid. And again, as a reminder, these are the crystals. So this first one over here is polarized light. And these are the typical needle-shaped crystals from gout. And this is with a red compensating filter and you're seeing the red and blue negatively birefringent needle-shaped crystals. Another thing to remember is that while white blood cells will try to phagocytize the crystals in gout, they're not usually successful. So not unusual to see a gout crystal piercing a white cell right in the middle of it. That's acute gout. You only need one crystal, by the way. All right, so there's got to be some rheumatologist in the room here. What's this? Anybody want to guess for me? Shout it out. I'll give you two choices, talcum powder or gout. It's both of them. And I really can't tell the difference. This is called a Maltese cross if it's gout, and this is a group of gout crystals together. That's what this one actually was over here. So these yellow and blue crystals in a big clump, and this is powder from gloves. So an easy area to get confused. Now we have lots of powderless gloves, but if there's any in the lab area that had powder on them, it can get on the slide, show up looking like this. So an easy area to get fooled. All right, you saw these once before. These are calcium pyrophosphate crystals, positively birefringent, parallelogram-shaped crystals. So again, yellow and blue, but they have a completely different shape than gout crystals, and these are positively birefringent instead of negatively birefringent. These are cholesterol crystals. To me, they always look like sheets of mica because I did geology back decades ago. They're these flat, you can see through them, and they have this little corner cut out of them over here that you can see. These are not a sign of elevated cholesterol or hyperlipidemia or triglyceride problems. It's a sign that the fluid has been in the joint for a long time. Once it's been sitting there for a while, not unusual to get cholesterol crystals. Lipid crystals, on the other hand, which are these white blobs, they're usually in groups of four together. So you can see here this group of four of them. They look like four ping pong balls stuck together. That's how I always remember them. Those are a sign of hyperlipidemia and of abnormalities in cholesterol metabolism. And then this is the alizarin red stain that I hope you will all remember and look brilliant to all of your students when you have them down the road. I hope you all have students and teach. And this is, if you can see them, what they would look like under light microscopy. And calcium apatite crystals, and this is the von Kossel black stain. Again, not normally visible under light microscopy, but with alizarin red or von Kossel black, you can see the calcium in them, and this is a von Kossel black stain that's positive. And here are steroid crystals, and that's not an uncommon finding. Your patient went to the local orthopedic surgeon, got a joint injection. Their joint was red, swollen, painful. You were worried about them when they came to you. You didn't know, did it get infected? What disease we were dealing with? The orthopedist, unlike all of you brilliant doctors in the audience here, didn't run the synovial fluid test, so you don't have an answer. So you tap it, you go to look at it, and what you find are these things, which look a lot like gout crystals, and can be very confusing. And those are actually from the steroids that were injected into the joint. So again, part of the differential for a crystalline disease. And these blue ones here can look a little bit like calcium pyrophosphate. This certainly looks more like gout. They can look both ways. And this is synovial fluid with ochronosis, where you can actually see the deposits dropping down. This is a tissue biopsy of the same disorder.